Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I am the Bill Arnold part of that sentence. Awfully glad you joined me. I hope you had a great weekend, possibly out of your weekend clothes and into your workday clothes. I hope you had a good day or having a good day. If you are listening on the job, I appreciate the fact you can listen on the job. That's kind of a nice perk. And if you're just heading in your car on the way home, I hope your day has gone really well. And we've got a great time coming up with Chaplain Dale Swan. He's going to tell some amazing stories. I love this verse that says in Psalm 116, verse 15, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. I've got an in-studio guest. You know that always makes me very happy. Dale Swan has been a hospice chaplain for over 22 years, and he sent me a book over called Hospice Hope, Uplifting Stories of Those in Hospice. And it takes someone with a lot of strength to be in that environment all day long, 5 or 6 days a week. And I would imagine some of the stories that you would accumulate over years of being in a person's final moments would be powerful. And in fact, they are. And I've invited Dale to come in today and share some of those stories because you will be kind of amazed. So, Dale, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. It's nice to be here.
It is awfully nice. And your accumulated stories of over years of talking to people and being with them in their last moments have produced some amazing stories. And I think we're all encouraged by this, and also know that for many, we've gone through this phase of our life where we've had a loved one, we've lost a loved one, and we've either had a chaplain that showed up and made a difference or a chaplain that showed up and didn't make a difference. So I love the fact that you're one that shows up and makes a big difference.
Thanks.
Yeah. So let's just jump right into a story just to get our listeners acquainted with some of the work you've done.
Some people say one of my favorite stories that I've told that's in the book actually happened after knowing a couple through the journey of hospice, and then I was asked to do their service at the end for, we'll call him Ron. And they were a wonderful couple, and the service had beautiful songs of the old Rugged Cross, Amazing Grace, but the song they wanted to close with was their love song, which was Elvis Presley's Love Me Tender. And so I said, it's okay. It's in a funeral home. You have a little more freedom, you know. And so they brought in the Elvis CD with all of his number one hits, and I gave it to the director, and I said, we will close with this song, and I'll just announce an Elvis song so people know that's coming up. And the service went very nice. I announced the Elvis song. I sat down, and I suppose the writing is real small on an Elvis CD with all of his hits, and he proceeded to not cue up Love Me Tender. He queued up the wrong Elvis song to close the service. So instead of closing with Love Me Tender, he puts on Return to Sender instead. And all of a sudden, Return to Sender, address unknown. The irony was not lost on the congregation.
Oh, that's
everybody started laughing, you know. And I quick stood up and I said, I do hope at the end of our life we're returned to our sender, but you know, that's the wrong song. And he puts on the right one. And the end of the story was that I went up to this widow and I said, Carol, I'm so sorry that, and we made this mistake. And she said, no. She said, Ron and I had such a happy relationship. I have cried day and night and day and night since I lost Ron. But today, I laughed for the first time. And I think Ron maybe had something to do with that. And he let me know that it was okay to smile again. So that's one of the stories that's in the book.
I love it. Now, you're so passionate about what you do, which I appreciate, because you were drawn into this over 22 years ago, and this last year you were awarded the Lane Adams Quality of Life Service to Cancer Patients, which is a national award you received in Dallas. So congratulations for that, because you were up against some pretty good competition there.
And you know, and I speak for maybe a lot of hospice chaplains or chaplains across, and ministers, we're not really about awards. There's a certain side of us that says we're unprofitable servants. We're doing what we should do or want to do for the Lord. But you know what made it worthwhile? They had an article in the Star Tribune and such and papers around and got a little notoriety of it. But someone saw my article in the Star Trib, and she found me on Facebook and sent me a message. And she said, "You probably don't remember me, but I was 13 when you came to visit my dad, who was dying of cancer." And she said, "I still remember you and Dad playing guitar in the living room." And she said, "I'm 28 now. I have my own children. But," she said, "I will always be thankful for what you meant to my mom and me and my dad at that time. So thank you very much." And to me, that's what makes it all worthwhile.
Those moments, those end moments of a loved one, really punctuate life for people. Yeah. It's indelible, those experiences and those weeks and days surrounding the loss of someone. And you get to be pretty intimately involved with them.
I almost don't know how somebody can work in hospice for like more than 2 weeks and not believe there's something more. There is something more beyond this life, you know. And even I'll never forget going to a home where, well, the one sister was not the religious one. She said, "No, you're coming here for my sister, not for me." And I said, "Well, I'm here for everybody to support everybody." But and her sister was a lovely Christian woman who was looking forward to seeing her husband. They didn't have children. Her husband had died a couple years earlier and ready to go to heaven. At the end of her life, she had to go to a facility to get some symptom management from her sister's home. So I went to see her at the facility. She was pretty near the end, and I just asked her if she would like a little prayer. She had a little moment of alertness to say she was looking forward to seeing her husband and going to heaven. I prayed and I left. Well, I got a call from the nurse about 45 minutes later that she had died, and could I go back? Well, I called her sister, and I said, "Would you like me to come back?" She said, "No, I think I'm okay." I said, "Was her passing peaceful?" She said, "Yeah." Well, she said, "Something happened just before she died, and, well, you'd probably call it a God thing." And I said, "What was it?" "Well, you know, they'd given her some more morphine, and she was really out of it. I thought we'd heard the last from her." And all of a sudden, she opened her eyes wide, and she said, "Oh, Joyce, do you see them?" And I said, "See what? See who?" And she said, "Well, those two angels standing there." And she said, "You know, Chaplain Dale, I probably should have said, yes, they're nice or something, but I'm like, no, I don't see anything." And she closed her eyes, and she said, just like this, she said, "Well, they're beautiful." And she was gone. And she said, "Is that a God thing?" I said, "You can't make that up." I said, she had a little angel escort right to heaven. Yeah. You bet that's real.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. And that's the whole idea that when God ushers us into eternity, what kind of angelic resources does he use?
Yeah. People so many times have those experiences of seeing loved ones. The thin veil between this world and the next, I think, gets opened up in a certain way that we don't quite understand. Yeah. I love the Henry Van Dyke story of the ship. It's called Gone From My Sight, where it's about a ship that's leaving and getting farther away. And it's kind of like people watching their loved one slowly declining and getting away until that ship, it says, is just a speck on the horizon. And then she's gone. And then in his prose, Henry Van Dyke said, "Is it gone or is that ship not arriving on another shore, just full of mast and sail?" And
right.
And the crowd on that shore is raising a glad shout, "Here she comes." That's dying, she says. And I think that's what they experience. In fact, there's a story in my book about a Navy man that had died, and they wanted a nautical theme for the funeral. And I preached on Jesus calming the wind and the waves, and they had a wonderful soloist who sang the Bette Midler song, "Wind Beneath My Wings."
Mm-hmm.
Not a dry eye after she sang it. And so the poor granddaughter had to get up and read "Gone From My Sight," this poem about the ship, a story about the ship, after this "Wind Beneath My Wings" beautiful solo. I could tell she was nervous. And I think it was the great theologian Jerry Seinfeld who said, the two biggest fears of Americans are the fear of speaking in public and the fear of dying. So to speak at a funeral is kind of a double whammy, you know.
Yeah.
So she gets up and she's nervous and she's crying and she says, "And in honor of Grandpa Mike, I'm going to read Gone with the Wind." And I thought, this is going to be a really long funeral, but we got through it anyway. But
yeah.
anyway, another story. The book is just full of little vignettes and stories, kind of like a chicken soup for the hospice soul book, that hopefully it can be uplifting.
Yeah. What is it like to have conversations with people who start to know that eternity is very real, and they're at the cusp of entering it?
George Gallup had a poll a number of years ago, and he asked people of all demographics and in the nation, what do you think about if you find out you are going to die, or when you think about death? And his results were really almost like a sermon to me. The number one concern, this is George Gallup's words, was that people want to know if there is hope beyond the grave. I mean, that there's something more. And it may look different to some different people, you know, but that was the number one concern that people had. And so I have no problem asking people what they feel about the afterlife. I had a young man who had grown up in Iowa in a Lutheran town, very traditional, confirmed and everything. And at this time, he was exploring the Buddhist faith. I said, well, what are you looking forward to then? He said, I want the afterlife to be nirvana. And I said, well, what does that mean to you? He said, I want to go to a place, what is the absence of everything. I want to be at a place where you just become one with the universe and part of the energy of the world, and there's no more pain. And I said, well, I've sort of studied that. I do know there's no more pain, but there's not necessarily happiness or personal existence. He said, that's right. And then he said this, I want to go to a state of perfect nothingness. And I don't know what got into me, but sometimes I have a sense of humor that gets me in trouble. But I said to him, I said, Chris, a state of perfect nothingness, it's where you're from. It's called Iowa. And he started laughing, and the tears were streaming down his face. But something happened in that little joke, that little laughter, that we connected. And I had the chance to develop a relationship with this younger man in hospice. In fact, when I'm walking out to the car afterwards, his wife comes running out there, and she's bawling, and I'm thinking, oh, no, she's from Iowa, too. And she just said, it was so good to hear my husband laugh. He's just been so depressed, and just the existential angst that you can experience at this time. But it really opened up a door. And by the end, actually, he was listening to the Bible on the internet, which would play for him. It would give him comfort at night, and that's how he died. When I did his service, his wife called me the night before the service and said, you know, all his relatives are coming from Iowa tomorrow. You've got to tell that story. So not that I'm trying to get that. But anyway, hope beyond the grave was number one. The second thing that Gallup said was that they want to know that their life had meaning, that there was significance, that they'd be remembered. What's my legacy? And the third thing that people wondered about when they were thinking about eternity and the end of life was they wanted to be at peace. Was there unfinished business? Do they have regrets?
All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I'll probably need to apologize to all the people living in Iowa who's listening right now. And then if you are craving an afternoon cup of coffee, you're going to want a donut as well. And that's because the story that's coming up next is going to have you craving a donut. Take a short break and be right back with more of Chaplain Dale Swan in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm so glad you're with me today. Chaplain Dale Swan is in studio with me. He's written a book called Hospice Hope, Uplifting Stories of Those in Hospice. And if you wanted to pick up a little copy of this book, you go to ebay.com, and then the way to track it down would be to type in the word Hospice Hope Swan. So that would be how to track this book down. Now, Dale, as you have had so many experiences with end-of-life experiences with people, sometimes a simple act of kindness is the way that a door opens in having a deeper discussion with someone, isn't it?
Yeah, one of my favorite experiences through the years was a man that actually didn't want chaplain, but his wife wanted him to have chaplain. And so, oh, he's got issues. I know. We'll sign up for chaplain. I went to see him. He let me know he didn't want to talk about religion at that time. But we did talk about the Minnesota Twins. We talked about labs. We both had black labs growing up. And his son had just gotten engaged. And I would always ask him after each visit, would you like a little prayer? And he'd be like, no, not really. The next month, he'd let me come back. We'd talk about many different things. Would you like a prayer? No. This went on for month after month after month. And I think, I'm never going to get a prayer in with this guy. But then one time I asked him, would you like a prayer, John? Yeah, I would. You would? What do you want a prayer for? He said, I'd like a prayer for a Krispy Kreme donut. And at that time, the Krispy Kreme donuts hadn't made it to Minneapolis yet. I knew they were in Chicago because my niece had gotten us some Krispy Kreme donuts in Chicago. And I said, the only place are Chicago, and I would drive down there to get you a Krispy Kreme donut just to answer your prayer. Well, I didn't do it, but he let me come back the next month. In those days, I picked up my check at the office before direct deposit. This is a while back. And Carissa at the office handed me the check, and she said, would you like a donut with that check, Dale? I said, sure. Well, they're special donuts. They're Krispy Kreme donuts. I said, why do you have Krispy Kreme donuts? She said, my folks were in Chicago, and they always bring me back a dozen. I said, can I have two? And I said, she goes, sure, why? She says, well, in about 20 minutes, I'm going to a guy that I have asked for prayer for months, and you are giving me the answer to his prayer 20 minutes before I go to see him. And she started crying. I've never been the answer to anybody's prayer before. So I head up, and I've got these two donuts in a bag all the way up to his place, and Satan is telling me the whole way, eat them both, eat them both. But I resisted temptation. I got to his place, and I said, John, your prayers have been answered. And he looks in the bag, and he says, are these Krispy Kreme? I said, yes, and I was hoping we'd have a little communion with the Krispy Kreme donuts. And he goes, and you brought one for Joanne, his wife. I'm like, shoot. But something about that little act of kindness, he opened up to me, and he opened up about some childhood hurts, things that he carried, shame, regret, things in his life that he felt estranged from God from, and we had the opportunity to pray together that he would find peace with God, he would find forgiveness, and it was just a release. It was such a wonderful time. He asked me at that time to do his funeral. I went on vacation the next week. I never saw him again. He died a week later. But I did his funeral, and it was a joy to do that funeral. And then about a year later, I got a call from his son who asked me to do his wedding as well. And so I wish they would have served Krispy Kreme donuts at the reception, but they didn't. But
that would have been nice.
But, you know, the scriptures say that it is the kindness of God, Romans 2:4, it is the kindness of God that leads one to faith and repentance. I mean, it may not be banging the Bible over somebody's head or hell and brimstone fire preaching. The kindness, the goodness, the grace of God that really can open someone up to the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Dale, talk about God's timing in situations, because you must have a lot of stories of people that have been somehow miraculously been able to hang on until loved ones arrived. Or I just went through that over the weekend with a friend, and this person came overseas on a 24-hour flight. Made it. And her mother was in a rough state, kind of unconscious for several days, and she opened her eyes and called her by name, and she was gone a few hours later.
The stories are just incredible. God's timepiece is so amazing. Even the arrangements of things at the end of life. I had a veteran that I just loved at a nursing home, and I knew he was going to go sometime soon, but he was holding on. He was one of those World War II vets just hanging in there. But his wife called me and asked if I would help him. Would I ask him to have the priest come in and do the anointing of the sick? She felt that would help him, bring him at peace. But he'd felt estranged from the church for a long time. And so I asked him if he would like me to do that. The only reason he actually wanted me to come was because, and his wife told me this, he just wants to tell you stories about the war. And he had a friend there in World War II in Italy. It was a Catholic priest, Father Jansen, who he got to take around in the Jeep to do services with the soldiers. And he had a special place in his heart for this chaplain, so he thought having another chaplain would help him along this journey. Well, I would ask him about having the priest come in. Nope, he didn't want the priest to come in, And finally, now he's declining. I think he's going to go that weekend, and he tells me it's okay to bring the priest in. And I called up the priest that I knew from the local parish, and they said he was on sabbatical. And I'm like, no, I need a priest this weekend. I've been asking a guy for months to get the priest in here, and what can I do? And they said, well, we have an old retired priest coming down from Collegeville that's covering for him at this time. And I said, here's the name. He's got to see him this weekend. Well, don't you know, he's still here that Monday. I drive up because I want to see him, and he's really declining at this point. And I say, you're still with us? He said, yes. He said, but I've got to thank you for getting that priest to come here. I said, well, that's good. Yeah, I was glad he could come. But he said, how did you find Father Jansen? I said, Father Jansen? He said, yeah, I haven't seen him since we left Italy in 1945. Here he was, a Benedictine priest who'd retired up in Collegeville. And this old guy who was still full of energy, he's still out visiting people.
Wow.
And these two old army buddies got together 2 days before he died. And I think that was him letting, it was God's grace and God's timing to let this man know, you're okay in my sight. You know, I love you. I'm going to even get you together with your old army buddy. And so it's stuff that you just cannot make up at all. And it's always such a blessing to, you know, and I get surprised all the time. Well, I'm always surprised. I'll tell you what I just got surprised by, though. Can I tell this? So it's a funeral, and the son is all nervous about giving the eulogy for his mother. And I told him, just be yourself. Speak from the heart. He goes up to give the eulogy, and his mom is in the casket before him. And just as he stands up to give the eulogy, his cell phone went off, just with a nasty ring, too. I mean, jaws drop. It's a big faux pas. And then he takes it out, and I think he's going to, you know, turn it off. And he answers it as well. I'm thinking, you can't be answering it. And he goes, hello? Oh, hi, Mom. I mean, the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, there's some things I'd wanted to tell you, and I didn't have the chance to. And he said, I'm going to tell you now. And he goes into the most beautiful eulogy for his mother you'd ever heard. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. And in the end, he said, Mom, I'm not going to say goodbye. I'm just going to say, I'll see you later. So see you later, Mom. I love you. And he hangs up the phone, puts it in his pocket, and walks down. But what a surprise. But what a beautiful, beautiful,
beautiful
eulogy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Chaplain Dale Swan has been my guest. And what a great time to have you come in studio and tell some amazing stories of how God works in the lives of the departing at such a critical time in their life. His book is called Hospice Hope, Uplifting Stories of Those in Hospice. Again, the only way to get this book is go to ebay.com and type in Hospice Hope Swan. And Dale said it's $25, but if you want it signed, it's only $10. So thanks for coming in, Dale. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you.
Yep. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. The show, you know, I love experts. I'm never going to be one, but I love them, and I love when they're on my show. Dr. Teal Mumar is one of them. He's a best-selling author, and he knows a lot about Generation Y and Generation Z. He's the CEO of Growing Leaders, which is a global nonprofit organization created to develop emerging leaders, and he and his team equip schools to empower students with real-life leadership skills. He's written some books, and he's just such an engaging guest. I said, let's have Tim Elmore back on, and here he is. Hi, Tim.
Hey, good to be with you.
Yeah, no kidding. Say, I would love to talk about the characteristics of the world the kids are growing up in today.
Wow, that's a big question.
Well, I mean,
you've launched with a big one.
I know. I'm going to start with the big one because I think this is it's called SEEN. It's an acronym.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I think I'd love for you to walk us through that.
Absolutely. It's such an easy way to remember, but it's so helpful, I think, for all of us as caring adults who care about kids. So I'll do it really rapidly here.
You don't have to do it rapidly.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. This is such good stuff.
So, listeners, if you will imagine two columns, okay, a left-hand column and a right-hand column, I call this our scene today. And it's basically a way to describe the culture that we live in the 21st century and the realities that that culture brings. But then on the right-hand side of these two columns, I want to give you the unintended consequences of that scenario, what we perhaps didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
So the letter S in scene reminds us we live in a world of speed. We want everything faster and faster, high-speed internet access, quick customer service, etc. But think about it. If you're a kid that's grown up in a world of speed, if that's all they've ever known is instant gratification, you're easily going to assume – you don't have to, but you're going to easily assume that slow is bad. I don't like slow. I can't even navigate slow. And I'll admit, I think I'm a little less patient today than I was 15 years ago because everything's so fast. The letter C in scene is we live in a world of convenience. And my guess is we all love the modern-day conveniences we enjoy. I wouldn't want to be without them. I love that quick click where I can order food delivered
totally.
To my house or whatever.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if I'm growing up in a world of convenience, it's so easy to assume that hard is bad. Now, here's something interesting. The number one phrase that K-12 educators say they hear from students today, this is too hard. They actually tell their teacher, this is too hard. It's like, I'm on a video game. I'm not on level 4. Bring me down to level 2, you know? And
yeah.
Of course, the teacher wants to go, we've been doing this math equation for decades, Johnny. You can do it too. But
uh-huh.
it's a result of just living in a world of speed and convenience. The letter E reminds us we live in a world of entertainment. And now that entertainment is in our hand all the time. It's a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
So if I grow up in a world of entertainment, I can easily assume that boring is bad. And let's just face it, all of us want a little stimuli coming at us all the time. Nobody likes to be bored. I didn't like to be bored when I was 16 years old. But let me tell you what we didn't know then that we do know now. Neuroscientists tell us today that our brains actually need boredom. They say it's in times of boredom when you have space and margin in your day and there's a little quiet that you actually develop empathy and creativity.
Oh, that's so interesting, Tim.
Yeah, two huge kingdom elements.
Wow.
I think Christ talked about. So think about it. Think about the opposite. If you're living in a world that I'm describing of noise and clutter, earbuds in all the time, noise coming
mm-hmm.
at you, I'm not thinking about anybody else. I'm trying to survive the week.
Right.
I think far too often we got a kid that's just trying to survive the week rather than thinking about what can I do for others? How can I change the world? So the letter N in scene, we live in a world of nurture. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. Have you noticed how absolutely safety-obsessed our world has become in the last 20 years? I mean, we've taken monkey bars off the playground because they're too dangerous. You know, knee pads, elbow pads, insurance policies, guarantees. I often joke when I'm with parents, we're putting helmets on the kids at dinner time. It's ridiculous. I mean, that's an overspeak, but mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying.
I know.
Well, think about the unwitting message we're sending to kids. If safety, 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 nurture, nurture, nurture. I think they're getting the message, risk is bad. Don't take any risk. Don't do it. Don't fail. In fact, you'll be interested. I think you'll be interested to know this. We not only hear about FOMO from students, fear of missing out,
mm-hmm.
and FOBO, fear of being offline. We're hearing FOMU, fear of messing up. Kids are actually riddled with anxiety and fears about never making a mistake because the pressure's on to make the grade, make the team, make the cut. And I think sometimes that's imposed by us unwittingly by this safety thing. So my feeling on this, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, is it's okay to let your kids skin their knee. It's okay to have them get a bad grade once in a while and say, what do we learn from this? But we're in this high-pressure cooker that just sends the message risk is bad.
By the way,
one more thing I would.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just wondering if some of the thrill sports, some of the real high risk, dangerous stuff isn't rebellion to the nurturing that they went through, because I don't like commercials where, you know, the side effect could be like death, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's skateboard over this mountain.
Absolutely it is. In fact, very oftentimes we see kids, the first moment they got any element of freedom where there's not an adult prescribing their behavior, they are doing something zany because it's the only time they've gotten to be a teenager, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm out there without somebody saying, put a pad on, or, you know, or whatever. Now, I don't mean to overspeak, but let me do one more letter in scene. So we live in a world of speed, convenience, entertainment, nurture. The last letter E It's not everywhere, but boy, I bet you every listener will go, yep, I've seen that. We live in a world of entitlement. We feel entitled to perks and special benefits, and we're special people, and give me a trophy just for showing up, you know, that sort of thing. And if we grow up, if a kid grows up in that world, it's not their fault. We raised them. But if they grow up in a world of entitlement, it's so easy to assume that labor is bad. I shouldn't have to work for this. This should be a part of the scholarship I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what I'm sounding like as an old grandpa here, but listeners, all I'm saying to you is that right-hand column that I just described, slow, hard, boring, risk, and labor, it dawned on me when I first scribbled this out, aren't those the very elements that grow me into a good adult, into a good disciple, into a good husband, into a good father, good parent, is when things are a little bit slow and I do have to struggle a bit. So all we've got to do, I'm not saying it's impossible to raise a great young adult in today's world. We have to be way more intentional today than we did even 25 years ago because the world is just different.
All right, Tim, I'm going to go back over the list on both sides. I want to start with some of the consequences that slow is bad, and ask any accomplished person that does anything well, and nobody's going to say, well, I was able to play Beethoven, four weeks.
Overnight.
I was able to play the fifth movement.
True.
I mean, I think everybody, we spend a lot of money to go watch people do that, to play Beethoven.
Yeah, it's true, because they gave the time to it, yeah.
Yes, and slow is good because it's methodical, it's disciplined, and you're turning yourself over to a discipline, which is wonderful.
Yes, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is our 21st century world that we all love of, you know, high tech, high speed, it's contrary to the development of skill sets that we desperately need to be great people. And that's why let me tell you a quick story. So we work with a number of professional teams, baseball, football, basketball. I was just with the Kansas City Royals a couple of years ago doing this scene thing that we just did. And J.J. Piccolo, the assistant general manager of the Kansas City Royals, looked at that list and said, oh, my gosh, slow, hard, boring. He said, that's baseball right there. It's slow. It's hard. You know, and we all laughed in the room because we thought that if you learn that skill of playing baseball at a high level, you know it's slow. You know it's hard hitting a fastball or a curveball. But this is getting you ready to apply, I think, some of those skill sets and the other parts of your life. So that's what we're after at Growing Leaders, is helping kids do that. Yeah.
All right, Tim, how do you sell this to kids? Slow is good, hard is good, boring is good, risk is good, and labor is good. How do you sell this?
I know, that's a hard sell.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
Well, I don't know if this is a great answer, but it's my answer. I was just with students this morning, the top senior high school seniors in Gwinnett County, just north of Atlanta.
Okay.
And we were talking about this, and we talked about the fact, do you guys want an edge on your peers as you graduate in the job market? This will give you an edge. Every employer is going to want you who says labor is good, slow is good. Let's bring it on. It's almost like strength and conditioning. You know, if you're an athlete, you lift weights to get your biceps and triceps and abs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is social training. This is emotional. This is spiritual. This is intellectual. It's applying strength and conditioning exercises to build this skill set. So let me give you one example. I talked to my own kids about this when they were growing up. They're now age 30 and 26. But we were talking about this, and my kids, I noticed they were getting very good on screens but weren't really good sometimes face-to-face with people. You know, that's sometimes how teens are, better on a screen than a face-to-face conversation. So one of the things my wife and I did was we had parties at our house for our adult friends, but we started having our kids host the party and learn the art of hosting a conversation, answering the door, inviting Mrs. Johnson in, asking if she met Mrs. Smith. Well, could I take your coat? Would you like an iced tea? And I know. At first they said, oh, my gosh, this is so stupid. But they learned.
It's not. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
So, and you know what? The one thing I would add, too, is that is far better than my lecture on the subject of you need people skills in your life. That exercise prompted great discussions with it's actually kind of hard to host a conversation with somebody that doesn't talk very well. But that's how you build the skill, not by talking about it, but by lifting the weight.
I would say one of the most impressive things that I encounter is when you run into a friend and he's with his son or daughter that might be 14 or 15, and they know exactly how to speak to an adult they don't know.
Yeah,
they're not
powerful.
Like they're not standing off to the side looking at their phone while dad talks to somebody. They're engaged. They give you eye contact. They shake your hand. They ask you a question, and that's when you practically go, okay, you're going to be successful.
Yes, I'm going to be working for you someday.
I know.
No, I love that. And here's what's crazy. It takes so little to build that skill. It doesn't take it. In other words, that's a fundamental that we should be building into our kids. It's doable. And then that job interview when they're 22 goes so well and they differentiate themselves from other prospects because they can look you in the eye and say, how are you doing, sir? You know, it sounds old fashioned, but you and I both know that is as relevant as anything else today.
Well, I even think of when I was a kid, I mean, the old days of answering the phone, Arnold Residence, Bill speaking. I mean, I know that's a little
that's
outdated,
exactly right.
But there was a certain level of civility and manners that you exhibited.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And if I can just jump ahead, one of the dilemmas we face today as adults is we've cared so much for these kids. That's good. We've overfunctioned. We've been so prescriptive. We've done some of the work for our kid. Not all the time, but I bump into educators all the time that said, oh, yeah, these kids have never filled out a form. Mom's always filled it out for them. If they forget their backpack or their gym shorts, mom rushes it down. And so they're not learning some of the life skills of problem solving and, you know, negotiating with a teacher when they don't have the gym shorts that they need to learn. So let me tell you a story. You're going to love this. I was just at a human resource executive conference speaking, and one of the HR execs came up during the break and said, Tim, you're not going to believe this. She said, I thought this might be an anomaly, but it's happened 6 times in the last 2 months. She said, I just handed a job offer to a recently graduated college student who's now a young professional. Every one of these 6 said, thank you. But after a pause, they said, but now my parents need to interview you to make sure you're a suitable boss for me. Every one of those job candidates were ushered to the door and did not get the job because mama was intrusive and didn't let their son or daughter become the man or the woman they were supposed to become. And so it was well-intentioned, but moms and dads listening right now, can I just say, let them grow up. Let them skin their knee. Let them fail a time or two when the stakes are relatively low. They're going to be much higher when they're older. And I feel like we've got to perhaps make a mental shift and let them fly on their own.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the entitlement thing, Tim, and I think of, you know, when kids lose 13 baseball games and get a trophy, they learn they learn nothing because then they get to be 21 or 22 years old and they go to their first meeting that they have is at their new job and they offer a suggestion and it gets shot down and they don't know how to deal with it because they usually get a trophy for that.
No, you're exactly right. In fact, let me give you an illustration. Unfortunately, school originally was intended to prepare kids for the norms of society. When Horace Mann started the public school system in America, or the reformed public school system in the 1860s, he said, I call this the normal school, prepare kids for the norms of society. So fast forward. Just last month, there was a teacher, a high school teacher in Florida, maybe you heard about it, Diane Tirado, who was fired by her school because she refused to give 50% grade to students that turned no work in. Now, let me reiterate. She said, well, I think we should give a zero if they turn no work in. That's how jobs are going to be. If you don't do any work, you don't get half a salary for doing nothing. But the school actually fired her. And I'm sure there was some logical reason, but she actually said to her kids, I love you all. I wish you the best. Because I wouldn't give you a zero, because I wouldn't give you a 50%, I just got let go. Well, let me just give you my logic on this. So I'm thinking, well, a kid's going to figure out, well, if I do half the work, do I get 100%? And if I do all the work, do I get 150%? It just doesn't work. And you and I both know employers are not going to give partial salary for someone that doesn't show up. It just doesn't get them ready. We need to be thinking long term. The further out we can see into the future, the better the decision we make today for our kids.
All right, Tim, what if we have some parents right now wincing a little bit like, ooh,
yes,
I might be doing a couple things that I need to fix here.
Yeah. So you're asking for expert in coming up.
Yes, I am. You're the expert, Tim.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll do my best. First of all, Mom and Dad, don't feel like there's an unsolvable crime that's been committed here. This is not the end of the world. But I tell you what, when I noticed that I wasn't preparing my kids, I was only protecting my kids, I sat down with them and I apologized. In other words, I took I fell on the sword and I said, you guys, to my son and daughter, I feel like I've not been a good dad because I've done this for you when I really should have let you do it yourself. And they kind of tilted their head like a puppy dog at a new dish, you know, saying, should I eat this or not, you know? And I went on to say, from this point on, I'm going to commit myself to letting you try it. And I'll be with you, you know, and I'll guide you, but I'm going to be a guide, not a God. I'm not going to do it for you. And that was a huge step. But I want you to know what I started with was I apologized to them. I changed my ways and then explained from this point on, I'm going to demonstrate for you that you have what it takes to be a man or to be a woman as a young teen. And so we did a rite of passage experience. And we really helped them move from childhood to adulthood, not overnight, but over time by me starting with an apology. So moms and dads, just consider, I don't know where you are, but you may want to say, okay, I do need to change. And that begins with me sitting down with my son or daughter and saying, I've not done a good job. I've done a better job protecting than preparing.
Mm-hmm. And they're so well-intentioned. There's nothing you want to do more than protect
Absolutely.
Your kids.
No doubt about it. You're right.
Yeah. So I don't know, you know, how parents find the discipline to consistently do the hard things for their kids. I was joking with a friend of mine. He said that he would, take his sweatshirt off, you know, pull it over his head inside out and throw it down the laundry. And his mom would wash it, but he'd get it back the same way. Because, you know, it's like, if you want it turned inside out, you turn it inside out before you throw it down the chute.
That's right.
It's not my job to turn it back inside out. I mean, there's so many little things I suppose you can do to help your kids be more self-sufficient. But I want to talk about the growing leaders. I mean, are you encouraged by what you're seeing with kids today?
Well, I'm both encouraged and discouraged.
Okay.
I'm encouraged with the thousands of schools that we're working with now that I'm seeing the students actually want to be responsible. When you cast vision for this, that you actually have what it takes to be a man, you have what it takes to be a woman, and to be a leader. We're about growing leaders. That's our name. It's so fun to see them light up and have an epiphany that they actually can do something. So that's fun. The discouraging thing is this. As I track the data that's out now, psychologists talk about an external locus of control in students and an internal locus of control. The difference is this. If you have an external locus of control, you basically are saying my success is really up to fate or up to external forces. Somebody out there needs to help me.
Mm-hmm.
If I have an internal locus of control, that means I'm basically saying my success in the future is up to me. You know, we've all heard that phrase, if it is to be, it's up to me. That's what my dad taught me, you know, growing up. So since the students have been measured the way back in 1954 with Dr. Julian Rotter, there's always been kids on both sides of that. You can imagine. Some kids are blaming everybody else and some kids are owning it. Since 2002, so over the last 15 years, 2003 to now, there's been an increase. I repeat, there's been an increase in external locus of control among students and a decrease in internal locus of control. That has me concerned. And when I ask myself why, I'm thinking, well, you know, social media out there, they're exposed to so much information, they can get overwhelmed and go, well, I can't change this. You know, somebody else has got to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's prescriptive leadership styles, as I mentioned, that parents are displaying that the kid goes, you know, it's up to mom. She's got to help me, you know. But for some reason, many reasons actually, I think these kids today are loaded with potential, but we're going to have to help them possess an internal locus of control. I've got to own what's mine. I've got to be a driver, not a passenger in my life, and steer my car, not blame somebody else when I don't get to where I want to go. And I just feel like that's what discourages me, that I think moms, dads, educators, coaches, youth pastors, we're going to have to work on building this sense of ownership that this is your life and you can do this.
Mm-hmm. Say, Tim, I'd love for you to apply a Christian principle to something you said just a minute or so ago. You know, if it's going to be, it's up to me. I mean, that's a great pull up your bootstraps and go make it happen thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But see if you can you apply a Christian principle to that, because it's a great line.
Yeah. Okay. So let me, do you mind? Let me give you another image and then I'm going to apply it scripturally. Okay.
Okay, great.
So I just gave the image of drivers and passengers. By the way, we teach leadership principles with images. So it just sticks in kids' brains.
Sure.
I call them screenagers, not teenagers. So we're using images. So another image is, it's called three buckets. And I basically say to students, and for that matter, anybody, everything that happens to you in your life falls into one of three buckets. And we cause angst for ourselves when we put experiences and people in the wrong bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Here they are. Bucket number one, it's in my control. Bucket number two, it's out of my control. And bucket number three, it's within my influence. So in my control, out of my control, within my influence. I think we need to respond wisely to each of those buckets. So bucket number one, in my control, I think God expects us to take responsibility, to initiate and not say, God, you do that for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, we all want to sit on the sofa and let God do all the work. He would say, you own this. Out of my control, that's where I do need to trust God. This is not my deal. This is his, and I need to let him do it, and I've got to trust. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known to God. The third bucket is kind of a combo of the first two. I need to respond wisely. I have influence. I can influence someone else, but I can't make them do anything. So here's a biblical example. If you remember the Old Testament, there's a couple of really famous stories of King David. The first one was before he became king, David and Goliath, the big story of, you know, the underdog, the little teenager fighting this big giant. The other famous story, if you remember, was David and Bathsheba. So I believe if you read that story, you see David actually misplacing elements in his life of those three buckets. So very rapidly, David is, if you remember the chapter, he's walking, 2 Samuel chapter 11, he's walking on the rooftops when all the kings usually go out to war. Well, he's a king. He should be going out to war with his men. But instead, he's home looking around the city, and of course, he sees Bathsheba. Oh my gosh, the trouble begins to brew.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not doing what he should be doing. And then if you remember, he wants Bathsheba, this neighbor's wife, misuses this. This is not in my control. This is not my wife. And then if you remember, he completely mishandles it at the end. He influences so poorly by calling Uriah, her husband, in. The story just unravels. My point is, David could have been so helped had he been responsible for his life, doing what's right, not neglecting what's right, and then trusting God to meet his needs rather than having some affair with a neighbor's wife. I mean, I'm being blunt now, but I think our problem is there's areas we got to trust and there's areas we got to just own it and say, this is my part of the partnership with God. I got to own this. So I'll stop there.
Speaking of buckets, you're a bucket of fun to talk to.
Well, thanks. It's just something I see we've got to do for our kids. We owe it to them.
Yeah. I'm going to try to tell a very fast story. There was a guest I had on the show, and the student got a test score that mortified her. She texted her mom. Her mom called her and said, put the teacher on in the class.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We hear this from time to time. I actually talked to a university president that said, somehow a mother got a hold of my phone number and called me and said, I've watched the Weather Channel. I've noticed it's a little cold up there. Can you make sure my son has his sweater on today? And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. I'm just sitting around waiting for phone calls. Now, we laugh at that, but I think this is an over-functioning mom who cares deeply for her son.
I think so, too.
But
Tim,
boy,
I gotta,
we're not letting them grow up.
Yeah, I got to run. Growingleaders.com is where you can go check out Dr. Tim Elmore. Thank you so much for being on the show. Have a great day.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Dr. Tim Elmore has been my guest. We'll take a little break and be right back with more. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.